All right. We are, I think as most of you know, beginning the study of Exodus this morning. And, of course, this is, in some ways, the second quarter of the new class system. For most, it's the first. But each quarter here in the auditorium, we will be studying what the majority of the classes will be studying the next quarter. And so, parents and teachers, hopefully, this helps, you know, you in your preparation for this next quarter. Your children will have the same memory passages. Now, let me just say, some of the youngest classes, they get condensed versions of the memory verses. It's the same verses, but, you know, maybe a little bit shorter. But you'll have the same passages. You know, as far as dividing the material, if I had just been putting together material for a study of Exodus in the adult class, I would have probably divided things up a little differently. But I'm trying to make it where it pretty much coincides with what would be studied next quarter. A little more depth to it, obviously. Let's do our memory verse. If you want to look on the sheet, it will be number one. It will, if you want to look in your Bible, it's Exodus 13:3. We're using the New King James because that's what our classes will be using. And everybody together. And Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, for by strength of hand the Lord brought you out of this place." Exodus 13:3. As we begin the study of Exodus, and I talked about Genesis being so foundational to the Bible, and it really is. You just don't understand the Bible without the book of Genesis. Well, Exodus is about as critical to that as Genesis. When you think about things that are introduced to us in Exodus that play a prominent part in the rest of the Bible, of course, the character Moses. I mean, he will be a key character in Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy. He'll be referenced many more times throughout the Bible. This is the book in which we have the nation of Israel for the first time. We've had Israel, the person. We've begun to see the family. But this is when they become a nation in this book. This is the book that gives us the Ten Commandments. It's the book that gives us the tabernacle. And think about in the New Testament, when Jesus is asked the question about, remember the woman that had the seven husbands? What's the scripture he turned to in his answer? Exodus 3. As he called it, in the burning bush passage. You know, they didn't have the chapter and verse divisions we have. He looks to the book of Exodus. Think about Stephen in Acts the 7th chapter. How much of that speech in Acts 7 is based on events of the book of Exodus, some of them even in our lesson today. 1 Corinthians 10, you remember the warning about being careful lest you fall. What's it based on? He says, he uses the Exodus and how they were all baptized into Moses and drank from the rock. And then he said, but many of them fell in the wilderness. That's the book of Numbers. But the Exodus is the basis of 1 Corinthians 10. The book of Hebrews. Oh, how many parts of Hebrews take us back to the book of Exodus? In chapter 12, he makes the contrast between that earthly Sinai and its quaking and trembling with the heavenly mount from which we get our law. There are references in Hebrews 11 to Moses and the Exodus. And then throughout the book, there are other references. I mean, just every reference to Moses and the law in the New Testament. I would say, what, two quarters ago, we looked at Romans. Key theme of Romans is the gospel versus the law of Moses that begins to be given to us here in the book of Exodus. So, very critical book to understanding the Bible story. I want us to go back to this familiar map and remember, real people in real places. The book of Genesis, the last part of it, focused about the promises to Abraham, a man who was from the land or the city of Ur. And God called him to leave Ur. What was his stopover before he reached Canaan? Haran, which is up here to the north. That's also the area where Jacob would go back to get a wife. But then he comes into the land of Canaan, today more commonly referred to as land of Palestine. But, and by the way, anybody know where the word Palestine comes from? Why it's not called Canaan? It's actually, tracing it back, it relates to the Philistines, which is odd. But I believe that's right. Don't quote me on that. And that name only comes in after the Bible, so it doesn't matter. But what were the three key parts of the promises to Abraham? He was going to make of him what? A great nation. He's going to give them what? The land of Canaan. And then ultimately the spiritual promise was that through his seed, what would happen? All the nations of the earth be blessed. Now, think where we are in the development of this. The Israelites have actually left the land of Canaan. They're living here in Goshen, a portion of Egypt. Now, when they went down to Egypt, how many of them were there? What was the number that's given? 70. As I said, 70 is a big family, but it's not a nation. But we have, at the end of Genesis, and the number 70 would not be the total when the book of Genesis ended, but when they went into Egypt, there were 70. They're beginning to grow. They're beginning to expand. But they are not yet that nation. Now, why had they left Canaan, which, of course, you remember, right up in here. Why have they come to settle in Goshen? They came to live with Joseph because what was happening in Canaan? There was a famine. That was the, shall we say, the obvious reason. Let's go back, though, for a moment to Genesis 15 and remind ourselves of something. Genesis 15, before Isaac is ever born. In fact, this is before Ishmael's even born. Look at what God had said to Abram. Verse 13, then he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs and will serve them. And they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge. Afterward, they shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. Start at the very end of that. God doesn't give Abraham the land, at least in part, because he says the iniquity of the Amorites, the wickedness, the sin of this land hasn't reached that point where I'm ready to destroy these inhabitants. Now, a few chapters later, there are four cities he destroys, Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, and Zeboam, but he's not yet giving it to him. But notice what he says. Your descendants, they will be strangers in a land not theirs. They will serve them. They will be afflicted. But he said, I will judge that nation. And they will come out with great possessions. You what? Well, the serving and afflicting starts here in chapter 1 of Exodus. Watch the judgment as it takes place over the next few lessons. And don't forget this part about coming out with great possessions. When we get to that last plague, So, what I'm saying is, and this thing about, if you have to say, and what I'm saying is, you probably are not saying it well, what I meant to say, in summary, how's that? On the surface, it would appear that they moved to Egypt only because of the famine. But the famine ends and they stay down there. Let's never forget, it was God's plan from the beginning that they would spend this time in Egypt. That this is where they grow and they develop. And things are going to happen and we're going to see it fulfilled just as God had said. And so when we come to the beginning of Exodus, and I believe in, I'm not going to go into all the evidence for it, but that Genesis and Exodus, I believe they were originally written as two separate books by Moses, not written long apart. But if you imagine this like a play, end of Genesis, they pull the curtain. And, you know, you hear some scurrying going on and, you know, some things are happening back behind the, if you've ever been to play, you know how that is. You hear all this noise. And then they open the curtain again. Well, they're in the same country that it ended, but a few hundred years have passed. And circumstances have changed. But take note of what God, through Moses, does very deliberately, I believe, at the beginning of the book. He reminds us of the names of those who've gone down into Egypt. The family of Israel. He wants us to link Genesis and Exodus together. And then look at, well, before we look at verse, I want to come to verse 7 and 8. But I want to tell you about something that is a very interesting historical fact that was largely unknown until, you know, the kind of late in the 20th century, and they're still learning a lot about this. Somewhere in the exact dates are going to vary according to references, but somewhere about 1750 BC, Egypt fell under the domination of a people. They were Asiatic. There's not a whole lot known about them other than Egypt is on the continent of Africa. A people came out of somewhere in the continent of Asia. They came to be referred to as the Hyksos, and they governed Egypt. You know, they were a minority within Egypt, but they had control of this country for about 200 years. Now, where they fit into the Bible story is fascinating because I think the most likely is, you know, somewhat like the Greek Empire and the Bible. You know, where Alexander the Great, though he's prophesied in Daniel 8, the story of the Greek Empire fits on that one page between Malachi and Matthew. You know, the whole rise and fall of the Greek Empire took place during the years of silence. Most likely, this part of Egypt's history takes place between the close of Genesis and the opening of Exodus. It's possible, some think, that Joseph rose to power under one of the first Hyksos kings, though I don't think that's the most likely. What I want you to think about is almost certainly, Moses is born about 1530 BC. What that means is the Egyptian people have suffered, I mean, at least how they would view it, under foreign domination for 200 years. They have finally expelled these foreign kings. They've got a native king back on the throne. And that may well help explain what we read in chapter 1 and verse 8. And by the way, you know, I noticed a couple of mistakes that somebody made typing these questions. And I guess since nobody helped me type it, I guess I'll have to take the blame for it. Number six, that obviously should have been the new king, not the new kind. And then number 11 should have been Exodus 6 and verse 20. Exodus 7:20 and Exodus 6:20, they're on the same opening in my Bible. That's my excuse. It's a pitiful one, but that Exodus 6:20 instead of 7:20, for those of you that wondered what connection, that would be it. But just keep this in mind. This is one of those things we don't know the exact connection, but I think there may be some of this. But I want you to start at verse 7. Look at how Moses says this. There's a redundancy here. You know, I had English teachers who would have marked me off, you use way too many words to say the same thing. But there's a point being made. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. They're fruitful, they increased, they multiplied, they grew. God is emphasizing here, the promise is really beginning to take off. They're not just a big family anymore. They're really growing, and they're growing to the point that the king fears them. Verse 8 says, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. In reality, we've had several kings who would not have known Joseph personally. I mean, there's probably at least a couple hundred years since the death of Joseph. But the point he's making is, here comes a king that Joseph's completely forgotten in his mind. He's no longer a hero. And when you think about the fact that, now we don't know, let me just say this, we don't know exactly when this king says the words he does in verses 9 and 10. But the enslavement begins sometime before the birth of Moses. It really makes sense if you think about them just having come out from under a foreign domination. And this king, who has no recollection at all of the great deeds of Joseph, looks up here in the land of Goshen, which is on their border, and he sees a people that's just getting bigger and bigger, and they're growing rapidly, and it strikes fear in his heart. And he, like politicians are prone to do, does a little exaggerating. Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we are. No, there weren't more of them. They probably weren't mightier. Keep in mind, this is more than 80 years before they leave the land of Egypt. You know, they're not at the number. They're, by the time of the Exodus in chapter 12, there's going to be 600,000 men that could fight. They're not near that number yet, because we're more than 80 years away. But they've grown enough that he's become frightened of them. And Look at what he says might happen. He said, if there's a war, now, invaders could come up from the south. There were some powerful people to the south. But so oftentimes, invaders are coming right through this direction. And look where the Israelites happen to be. And he says, enemy come into the land, and they may join with them. They may fight against us. And the end of verse 10 says, go up out of the land. That expression could be translated, go over the land, as in, they could take over. It had happened to them in their history. In fact, they well remember when it happened. So, whatever the reason, this king is, he's frightened of them. And he said, we've got to do something. So what's his first option for trying to slow the growth of Israel? Wear them out by working them. They make slaves of them. And they put taskmasters over them. And they built these supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, which exact locations are not certain, but you know there would be somewhere in this northern area here. I mean, probably a couple elements here. You know, they take a lot of the men away from their families to go off and build these cities. You know, thinking we separate them from their wives, that will decrease the population. We will, I mean, work them to death. I mean, the life of a slave meant nothing. You know, they didn't have mandatory OSHA water breaks and, every so many hours you got to give them this much rest and all of this. No. They're expecting this will probably do the job. Does it do the job? No. Look at verse 12. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. God is in his providence. He's not allowing this to work. You know, the Pharaoh, this king, thinks, I've got this great plan. You know, I mean, you think about it. He's going to solve two problems at once. He's going to suppress the growth of these people he's worried about, but he's also going get a lot of free work done. Can't beat that, can you? Well, he's getting the work done, but he's not holding their growth back. And so verse 12, they are in dread. And verse 13 and 14, they just made the work harder. They made them serve with rigor. They made their lives bitter. They made them work with mortar and brick and in the field. They are strongly, strongly oppressing them. But it's not working. It's not helping. So the king comes up with another idea. He decides, you know, I thought I could work them to death. We're just going to have to kill them. Something that is fascinating, and I never thought about this until this time, he never gives us the proper name of a king, a pharaoh, in the book of Exodus. But he tells us the names of these midwives. You know, the kings, they can be anonymous. You know, names mean a lot. I mean, we like it when people can call our names. You know, they don't just say, hey, you. God doesn't record the name of a single Pharaoh. But he recorded the names of these two midwives who, my guess would be that they're not the only two midwives, but they're probably the chiefs over the midwives. You know, they're probably over them, most likely by the number, you know. But that's immaterial. But the king says, look, when you go to deliver a baby, what was their job? If it's a little girl, what do? You let it live. If it's a boy, kill it. You know, it's the cruelty here. And what do the midwives do? They don't do it. And notice what it says. They feared God. I can't help but believe they had some fear of the king. A man that will order the death of innocent babies, who is the all-powerful ruler of a nation, is the kind of person you have a fear of. But they feared God more. And they refused to do this. Now, he doesn't say this, but I think the implication is probably the midwives were expected to, when it was a male, kill it discreetly. Make it look like a stillbirth. Like, you know, something happened, or, you know, you take that cord and you quickly wrap around the neck and the baby dies. And I say that because look at what they said to Pharaoh. Pharaoh asked, you know, why haven't you been killing these baby boys? And they said, well, they're born before we can get there. Well, if they're just taking and, you know, bashing, you know, male babies' heads on the floor, they could do that if they got there half an hour late. But if, you know, they're supposed to be, you know, trying to make it look like an accident or, you know, something natural, you can understand. But whatever the case, these women said no. They refused. In verse 20, it said that God dealt well with the midwives. God, verse 21, provided households for them, that these women who were charged with killing babies are blessed with babies as reward. Stephen?
John, where did they get the fear of God here? And has the God of Abraham, Jacob, and Isaac all been passed down through the generations, and their understanding of God is still there? And are they still following circumcision?
I think so. At least many of them. You know, I mean, there's a, how well they kept alive the knowledge that was passed down from Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph, we don't know, you know, details of. But I think that there is, I will say this, here's one thing I know. Moses, and this is getting ahead of ourselves, he doesn't circumcise his children. But he knew he was supposed to. He knew, you know, because, you know, Zipporah takes the knife and she does the act. They knew well that was what was supposed to have happened. So I think that knowledge was there.
All these stories about Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and how God had done powerful things through them, and Joseph, all the stories would be passed down to all the generations.
The idea of oral tradition, you know, oral, you know, telling family stories, you know, in that day would have meant more than even today, because, you know, there was no, hey, let's get grandpa to write down, you know, these things. People didn't do that, but they passed these things down. And so I think that at least among many, there are always exceptions, but among many, there would have been that knowledge. They would have known Abraham, And when God says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I don't think Moses scratched his head and said, who could those three people be? I mean, I think he knew that. And these women, I mean, it's encouraging that the stories have been kept alive that they could have faith. But you can have faith and be overcome by fear. And they were not. And that's really impressive. Anybody else? Well, the king is getting frustrated. He says, I thought hard work would do it. But what you notice is, even though that doesn't work, they keep enslaving them. You know, they don't say, okay, y'all can go back to being free again. And they keep them as slaves. The midwives didn't help out because, boy, those Hebrew women, they just had the babies before we could get there. You know he didn't believe that story. But what he says, he turns to his people. And remember verses 9 and 10. Like any good demagogue, he has told the people, you need to be scared of these folks. These folks, they're not like us. And they're going to take over us. And we got to do something. And then he turns to his people and he commands his people, if you see an Israelite son born, you throw him in the river. Feed him to the God of the Nile River. You know, that's what we're going to do here at this point. So, wow. That's a scary thing. Question arises. How many Egyptians did this? The Israelites are largely concentrated in this one area with a relatively low Egyptian population. How many babies were thrown into the river? And the answer to that is, we have no idea. But we know the threat was real. Because what we see Moses' mother do. You know, I don't think that every male for a period of, you know, however many years got thrown into the river. You know, there were probably those that were able to keep them hidden. And once they reached a certain age, you know, maybe they were reluctant to throw them in it. And I don't know how long this order stayed in place. But don't think for a moment it wasn't real, that it didn't happen to some. And at the time, verse 2, or chapter 2, verse 1, a man of the house of Levi, what do we learn later? His name is what? That's where the 620 would have been a better help to you than 720. Amram took a woman named Jochebed from the, they were both Levites, and they have a child. And at this time, there was legitimate fear for the life of the male child. What they do, and it's interesting to me that in Exodus, the emphasis is placed upon the mother. Hebrews 11 speaks of the parents in the plural. You know, the father had some part in this. But let me ask you, what was the father most likely doing most of the time? He was working as a slave. His life was bitter with hard, vigorous bondage. You know, he was probably away most of the time. And so, you know, she hides him. Verse 2, it's a good thing he was a nice-looking baby, right? If he had looked like that one baby on the wall at Cracker Barrel, and if any of you have ever sat in that one section and seen it, you know which one I'm talking about. Oh, you know, he's dead, you know, because she saw he was a beautiful... No, No, there's not a mother that doesn't look at their child and go, oh. You know, and I don't know, I'm certain that throughout the pregnancy, she would have had the idea, I can't kill this baby. But when she saw the baby, it strengthened her resolve that she was going to protect this child and she was going to do everything she could to protect him. And, you know, how does she come up with the plan she comes up with? Was God directing her? Or is this just a woman of great faith and fear of God that says, I got to do what I've got to do, and God in his providence made it all work out? It could be both. I don't know if she had any direction from God other than the knowledge that God doesn't want babies to be slaughtered. And so she's going to protect him. And I think Wednesday night, we'll pick it up right there with what she does. And next Sunday and next Wednesday also, we won't be having Bible class. So for Wednesday, go ahead and start lesson two. We won't finish it because we've got to finish up one. But because of the meeting, you know, we're going to lose that 1 week. So we kind of got to try to tighten up. And but be preparing for lesson two also for Wednesday night.